Good day, Policy Hats. Welcome back to Politics versus Policy with Jared and Sheila. Today we're doing our seventh episode on climate change policy. We have joining us here today Kennedy Beva. Thanks for joining us, Kennedy.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So Kennedy is a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne School of Social and Political Science. In his research, he specialises in the international political economy of trade and the environment. Previously, he was a research fellow at the public policy think tank, the African Centre of Technology Studies, focusing on climate policy. In 2014, he won a prestigious Green Talents Fellowship Award for high potentials in sustainability. Kennedy is also a contributing author of the upcoming APCC AR6 report, which will be launched next year. Impressive.
Very, very impressive. It's fantastic to have Kennedy in the pod room with us today, because it's always a pleasure to have him around. He's a very good influence on us, and he's always down for a great chat. So thank you again, Kennedy, for coming in.
And thanks for the invitation, and I'm happy to have another conversation. It's always interesting.
Yeah. So basically what we're kind of framing today's episode around is the global climate change policy, focusing on international as well as Australia, and also getting a view of how it affects trade, which Kennedy also focuses on in his studies. So climate change is a wicked problem, and it's an issue for all countries, including state actors and non-state actors, so you, me, and everyone else in the world. In addition, it is a catastrophic issue and a disaster for ecosystems at this current point around the world as well. Now, in this episode, we acknowledge that the topic of climate change is quite contested by a number of stakeholders. Not everyone shares the same views, scientifically or non-scientifically. But in this pod room, we're not scientists. We're, except for Kennedy, he might probably hold that a little bit more than us, but we're policy experts, which means that we'll be kind of framing this episode in agreement with the scientific consensus. So scientific consensus meaning that 97% or more of actively publishing climate scientists agree, that climate warming trends over the past century are extremely likely to human activities. Would you agree with that, Kennedy?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So through rising carbon emissions and the consistent destruction of habitats due to deforestation and human expansion, year by year we have witnessed record-setting temperatures, coral bleaching, ice caps melting, and a rapid speed-up of species extinction. And while the threat of rising sea levels, abnormal weather patterns, and more fearsome disasters looms larger, as the existential threat hits crisis points, can governments rise to meet the challenge with progressive policy, including carbon emission targets, pricing or taxing, or maybe the extremes of the Green New Deal in Australia and America? Or will governments remain complacent with their spray tan and fumble around with putting science off and putting mankind on track to fearful future that we can possibly not predict? So I'll leave it up to Sheila to hit up with the first question.
Yeah. So, well, Barack Obama, he stated, and I quote, "We cannot afford more of the same timid politics when the future of our planet is at stake. Global warming is not a someday problem, it is now." In your opinion, Kennedy, how do you think the international climate change policy looks like right now?
I think that's a very good question. And I think to start off, it's quite interesting how there have been quite some dramatic changes. You could remember a while back that in the early 90s, the US was actually one of the leaders in crafting an international response to climate change, and that was George W. Bush Sr. Mm-hmm. And that's when we had like the three Rio international agreements on the environment signed, one on biodiversity, one on climate change, one on desertification. But then we had a major milestone where in 1997 we had a major international agreement, the Kyoto Protocol, but then it was doomed to fail. Mm-hmm. Many scholars have written about the topic and speculated on why it failed. And part of the reason was sort of the agreement was a top-down, in the sense that the UN agency responsible for climate change set targets for a select number of countries, especially developed countries, to reduce their emissions and get them a timetable. But then several countries rejected it, including number one, Australia, which did not sign it. Canada as well, which sort of like walked back from it, and the United States, where Bill Clinton signed it, but George W. Bush did not have it. It could not be ratified during his tenure. So the whole logic at that time was it could not work. And, you know, the key argument was because China, you know, and because China was a shorthand for what happens to the emerging economies whose emissions are rising. And the argument was having just a select number of developed countries taking action or taking lead would not be sufficient. And that sort of there was a period of intense debate. And then the logic of international climate cooperation changed, where there was now a push towards universal participation, where every country could participate. So that was the bargain. And the grand bargain was that everyone could, each country should submit something, but then they should determine it from the bottom up and not the Kyoto Protocol of top down. And that's what led to the Paris Agreement on climate change, where each country would put a plan, but then they defined their own plan on what they, exactly they'd want to do. And then there was a collective goal where there was a temperature target of 2 degrees Celsius. And that is the temperature goal. So the logic shifted from a top-down sort of timetable where the UN sets the timetable for a select number of countries to a bottom-up approach where countries develop their own plan and they see how they will implement it.
And you mentioned Paris Agreement. How does that look like right now?
It looks quite interesting because one of the key things and one of the key things that scholars are looking at, for example, number one is the transition from negotiations, where the successful adoption of the Paris Agreement marked like the high water mark in international climate change cooperation. And it marked sort of a transition to the next phase, which is important, which is the implementation phase. So Paris has this mechanism called the ambition mechanism, where after every 5 years, the country submissions are reviewed and countries have to submit a stronger plan when compared to the previous plan that they had. So we'll have, I think this year will be 5 years sort of after Paris, where we should have the first round of sort of like conclusion of the first round of plans, and countries are expected to submit stronger plans. So the momentum of Paris at the moment has gone down a little bit because there was an expectation that all countries would submit stronger plans, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And some of the issues which have plagued previous efforts, for example, low-income countries are requesting for greater support through finance, technology, etc. They're claiming they haven't received that support yet, and a number of sort of developed countries are quite reluctant to take up much more effort. The US with Donald Trump, the politics in Australia, etc. So those politics are still there, but now the question is by the end of the year whether we'll have a really good number of countries strengthening their next round of national climate plans. So the question is still out there. We don't know yet. And this year will be a crucial year to determine whether the momentum of the Paris Agreement is still sort of building up or whether it's leveled off.
Now, I have a major question from kind of growing up in this world where climate change has become a bigger and bigger and bigger threat. I remember the days where it was used to be called global warming. And so I have a major, a question about, do you believe it was a mistake to label it as global warming before changing it to climate change, because it gives people like a difference of an idea of what it is?
I think that's a very interesting question. And the way I can frame it is looking at it like an equation, where global warming is one side of the equation. That is what, you know, like what is causing the changes in the climate. And the second part is the changes in the climate, which is climate change. So I think if you look at both, it's like two sides of the equation. Global warming, which is caused by sort of increased greenhouse gas emissions, but also leading to a change in climate. So climate change is a bit of a more comprehensive term, and it shows the impacts of global warming in a way. So I think part of the change in terminology also allowed sort of to capture quite a number of issues, because warming is only one part of the issues of the change in climate. There are many other impacts from that even proceed from that warming. For example, ocean acidification. Oceans are becoming more acidic as they absorb more carbon dioxide. You know, increased sort of a frequency and intensity of droughts and cyclones and extreme weather events, which have been there, yes, but climate change acts as a threat multiplier, where it makes those problems and those disasters more intense and shortens the cycles for such disasters. So I think in a bigger sense, climate change, that phrase captures more holistically what is happening and also the broad sort of types of impacts that are as a result of global warming, which is a result of greenhouse gas emissions. So that's the way I'd view it.
Yeah, so just put it, yeah, because that makes it so much easier for me, because I always used to frame like global warming as, look, the Earth is just warming up. That's basically all that was said. But then now basically we've changed that into, as you've said, the multiple factors are like, look, you've got the sea levels rising, but you've also got the like coral bleaching and the natural disasters that are looming, and they're going to intensify. So in Australia, we're going to have longer droughts, drier fire seasons. And then what would the effects really be across the globe, do you think, in terms of like Europe and Africa? And
so I think that's a really good question. And in some areas, actually, for the last couple of years or even decades, the impacts of climate change have been quite clear. For example, in the Sahel, that is in the Sahara region of Africa, we have places, parts of Senegal, Mali, Niger, where temperatures have risen by up to 4 degrees Celsius. And many areas have become uninhabitable, and you can actually draw a line between that and people moving from those areas and trying to emigrate to Europe. So you can see the impacts of climate change on that area. If you look at some of the small island nations, their coastlines are receding because the sea levels are rising, including Florida. That is Florida. In the U.S. And some other coastal areas where the sea levels are rising, and they're actually getting up to properties. And there was a very interesting, I think, finding sometime last year where I think Donald Trump got insurance for his properties against a sea level rise. So,
oh my God.
That's part of the irony. So climate change is happening everywhere. So the impacts of climate change are being felt in different places. Mm. And the impacts also vary depending on the location and also the intensity. So the fact that climate change is happening in different places is not disputable. So the question is, what types of impacts are most pronounced at which places?
We mentioned that you are specializing in the trade policy and environment. What do you think is the biggest challenge that you perceive at the moment internationally?
That is a very interesting question. And I can tie that to my previous experience in actually international climate policy. So a couple of years back, I think in 2012, I was part of my country's delegation to the UN climate change negotiations. That's Kenya. And it was a first-hand experience. I was very young back then, in my early 20s. So it was quite an interesting experience, because before that I'd been involved at the national level with sort of climate, sort of the process of making what ended up being Kenya's Climate Change Act, which was the first in Africa, and the enabling policies, but also looking at the negotiations at the international level. That was a first-hand experience of how challenging the negotiations were. But I think when I switch now to academia, I got a chance to sort of dig deeper and look at the problem and what scholarship had to say about those problems. And first of all, looking at the scholarship, for example, on international climate policy, like the cooperation at the international level, it was very interesting how the problem was redefined, as I mentioned initially, from, you know, this is the way we should tackle the problem, by having a small number of countries taking action, to sort of a bottom-up approach where all countries take action. So the biggest problem back then, like a couple of years ago, was getting all countries to agree to an international agreement. So some people are quite optimistic about the Paris Agreement. Others are quite pessimistic. And it depends, you know, on how they view the UN. Some view the UN as the institution that should, you know, push countries to, you know, get things done. But others think it's more of, it's supposed to facilitate cooperation among its countries, but countries at the end of the day decide what they'll do, because it's countries that negotiate other UN agencies. The UN Agency on Climate Change doesn't decide for countries what they'll do. Mm. It just offers a platform for them to negotiate. So I think the problem now would be almost each country has submitted a plan. How will those plans be implemented? And how do you build trust and what is being called ambition? Ambition meaning you do much more than you did the previous time. And that is the biggest challenge. And I think the other implication is with the plans being developed bottom up, the politics has shifted to the domestic level. So how does each country meet its commitments to the Paris Agreement? So the shift has been now from the international level, where the focus was on negotiation, to the national or domestic level, where implementation occurs. So that's where the challenge is.
Well, actually, with the question of trust with these policies and the whole Paris Agreement, one thing that we always kind of hear And one thing I wanted to ask you about with governments is that, do you believe that they manipulate their citizens to believe that their responsibilities in curbing emissions aren't as big as other countries? So like in Australia, we're not even in the top 15 of top carbon emitters of the world. So like number one is China, number two is United States, number three is India, four is Russia, and five is Japan. And we fit well below. So in terms of enacting policy and finding suitable policy, how do you believe that our government can approach, even though we're not a large carbon emission emitter, except per capita, that's where we're pretty bad, where do you believe that policy can kind of be implemented, or how we can find agreement?
That's a brilliant question. And if I'd frame it theoretically, I'd say the key insights from international relations would be a problem like climate change is clearly, as you can see, a two-level game. Mm. What do I mean by a two-level game? There's a domestic level, there's the international level. So at the domestic level, there's, of course, how should the costs and benefit, the costs and benefits of action on climate change, how should they be sort of, who gets to take up the cost, who gets to share the benefits? So how the costs and benefits are shared is a big issue. But then at the international level, countries care about what they do relative to what others do. Australia will care how much it does relative to what China would do or any other country. So politicians have to navigate those two levels, and that is why you'll hear them, for example, if politicians are finding, or policymakers are finding trouble sort of having quite a big challenge implementing the climate policy or not at the domestic level, they'll mostly point to international factors, especially if it's to the advantage that we emit only 1% of global emissions. Mm-hmm. So we should not do that much. But also there's a question of at the domestic level where the objectives might be a little bit different, or the priorities, because of the different constituencies at the domestic level. So politicians play that game between the international and the domestic.
So we've kind of touched on Australian domestic policy in terms of climate change. And in terms of the Scott Morrison government, one thing that they keep repeating basically every time climate change is brought up is that we're going to meet our Paris targets by far because we're using these carryover credits. Mm-hmm. Now, can you explain to us what carryover credits from the Kyoto Protocol really are, and how they, if they're actually effective in reducing emissions and reaching our targets?
That's quite an interesting question, because there's been a lot of confusion on that point, and part of it is due to the sort of a little bit of the technical nature of the issue. But the logic is very simple, and someone gave a very simple logic which actually captures the core of the issue, and that is, if you're playing in a sort of a certain league, maybe football or soccer, if you have a match today and you score 3 goals, they only count for that match. You don't use those goals for the next match. When you go to a different match, then you start from zero. So the logic is, imagine the previous match is the Kyoto Protocol and you scored 3 goals against your opponent. But then when you go to the next match against a different opponent, you want to count those 3 goals. And you say, okay, we are starting this match, but I'm 3 goals ahead. So, of course, you'd understand the reaction from your opponents and others. Mm. They say that's an unfair system. If a match is over, it's over. You don't carry over the goals. And so that is the logic of the credits from the Kyoto. So to begin with, critics say Australia had very low targets for the Kyoto Protocol. So that's why they overshot them. Whether that's true or not, let's take the point at its face value that they overshot their target. So they say we did much more than we expected to do in Kyoto. So we take that surplus that we did, we use it and count it as if we've done that to sort of meet our Paris targets. So we end up doing less than what we committed in the Paris Agreement. So that is where the sort of the dispute is. And people are arguing, if we really want ambition, then leave what you did in Kyoto. If you surpassed it, that is good. Good on you. But this is Paris. This is a new commitment. So you start afresh. If you're reducing your emissions by 26%, it should be 26%. And you can't use what you did in Kyoto to reduce that commitment. So that is where the debate is. And it again sort of touches on the issue of integrity. How does Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement relate? And number two, should countries be using loopholes to reduce the amount of climate action that they've committed to? And, those creative means, or should they be a bit more forthcoming and sort of be more forthright in their commitment and say, we want to advance and make our contribution and we will like pull our weight. So that's where the debate is over that issue, because the press, the fear is other countries will also start doing that, and that again erodes trust, which is a very crucial issue in such a complex problem.
And based on your observation, what's stopping Australia from committing to Paris Agreement as much as they did to Kyoto Protocol?
Part of it, that's a really good question. And I think part of, there are quite a number of factors. And initially, Kyoto had its own politics, and it's quite difficult to disentangle. But what is making Paris a little bit more difficult is now, all one, number one, like the level of attention the issue is getting. During the time of the Kyoto Protocol, climate change wasn't yet a high politics issue, as you'd say. But now climate change is high politics issue, especially at the international level. So there's a lot of attention and scrutiny on the topic. And number two, there's a lot of pressure now and interest at the domestic level, where climate change has also risen on the political agenda. And the different groups that are battling on the issue, whether it's the fossil fuel interest groups and the citizen groups, it's environmental groups, the politics is getting more quite contested and more intense. So the issue is getting much more visibility. So, and number three maybe is the issue of legitimacy, where before, Kyoto Protocol was really attacked as being a top down approach, where the international bureaucracy sets target for a sovereign nation and they have to meet it. So you could understand the attacks that are coming for them. But Paris is a bottom up, where countries formulate their own plans. So they can't say someone set the plans for them. And so when you look at all those factors in combination, then they might explain why there's a much more attention and contestation on Paris Agreement than there was on Kyoto Protocol.
We've spoken about like the five large countries that produce a large amount of emissions, carbon emissions into the atmosphere. So you can primarily put them in the developed countries sector, basically. In terms of constructing climate change policy, do you think that's much harder for developing countries without such developed industries and work sectors, rather than like Australia and United States?
One of the articles that we published, I published with a couple of colleagues, actually looked at how did countries define what was fair and ambitious for them. It was really interesting. And you could see for developed countries, the biggest challenge was, you know, the major emerging economies, because they framed their contribution is saying, you know, we're doing this, but there's this set of countries, China, Brazil, India, you know, Russia, those sorts of sets of countries, that set of countries whose emissions are rising rapidly. And in the future, they're going to account for a huge percentage or a bigger percentage of the emissions. So there was that debate. And also from the domestic level, you can tell right now the biggest debate or the one of the hottest issues is, how do we deal with government support for fossil fuels, whether it's through subsidies, because governments, especially in all over the world, but especially in developed countries, they give a lot of support to subsidize much of the cost for fossil fuel extraction and all that. And people are arguing they don't want to see the taxpayers' money go through such climate-damaging sectors. So, but there are many vested interests. For example, you can tell with Australia, you know, coal is a major export, you know, export earner for the country. So dealing with that sector is a bit difficult, because they also have a lot of political clout compared to other groups. So such problems start emerging. But in maybe lower income countries, there are still challenges, but they're a bit different in nature. And we did an analysis of the plans submitted by low income countries, and they had two types of targets. One was what we call unconditional target, where, for example, a country would say we'll reduce our emissions by 10% using our own resources. But there's also a second type of target, which is called conditional target, where they say if we get support, whether it's through technology, finance from developed countries, then we will increase our target to 30%. Mm. So 10% we use our own resources, 30% if we get support. So the different sets of challenges for the different kinds of or groups of countries, and that is, I think, is an indication of the difficulty of implementing climate change policy and the shift from negotiation to implementation, because that's where the rubber meets the road, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, we quickly talking about Australian climate change policy. We We always use the example of our carbon tax. That's probably one, like, why it's so hotly contested in Australia. That do you believe that Australia, with the Kevin Rudd, Gillard Rudd government, tried and like burned and crashed, or do you believe like that was just like the start and we can move forward from there?
It's a topic of very intense debate at the moment. Some say it's the best, especially economists say it's the best way to address this issue by taxing, you know, emissions, which is a negative externality in economic terms. But there are those who claim it's not sufficient. It might be necessary, but it's not sufficient. But the bigger debate is the cost and benefits. Who benefits from that? And what's the cost from that? But I'd put it in broader terms and say there are a couple of things that one has to consider when you look at when you're considering the use of such an instrument. And one of them would be the economic efficiency. You know, what are the costs and benefits, and how will they be distributed in society? Number two is the impact, you know, on climate. Like, will it lead to reduced emissions? Because I think the studies that show after the carbon tax, you know, emissions dropped, and that's part of one of the metrics that you can use to look at the effectiveness of the policy. But there's another aspect which had been underappreciated, but it's proving to be quite critical, which is the political sort of a stability of the policy. You can have a good policy, but it's taken away or sort of done away with very shortly, as you can tell, with that sort of a carbon tax in Australia. So a good policy, in my opinion, of course, depends on the domestic context of the country, but would respond to those three dimensions. Number one, distribution of costs and benefits. Number two, how much does it contribute to addressing the problem? And number two, the political feasibility. How feasible is it given the politics of that constituency? And that would sort of, in my opinion, dictate how good and effective climate policy should look like. Different places will have different instruments. So I think that is one of the things that is coming up. Like, countries will adopt different mix of tools, or even a set of tools where they have carbon tax as one tool, but also different types of tools.
Yeah. Before we go on, because we're going to probably move on to the EU and carbon trading soon, but I just want to stick with Australia for one more minute. Do you believe that Australia could come back to a carbon tax in a couple of years, like in maybe another government, or do you believe that how it was perceived and how we view it from how it crashed and burned and how we swapped from basically a Labor government to a Liberal government, do you believe that we'll ever see a carbon tax in Australia ever again?
What I'd say is that's a very interesting question, but I think the premise of the question is a bit misleading in the sense that climate change is a multifaceted issue. There's economics to it, but there's politics, there's ethics, there's morality, there's law. There are all those different components that you have to look at. And any response to climate change has to integrate all those dimensions. In some areas or some regions, some aspects are more pronounced than others. That's what I'd say. So the question would be, for example, like going forward, how is climate change framed in the Australian context? Some are framing it as, for example, let's deal with a sort of like carb or, you know, fossil fuel exports, especially coal, and maybe make our mining industry more sustainable. But there are those who are asking then, well, if we close that sort of stream of revenue, what do we substitute with? And some are arguing that we should look at other forms, for example, like solar. Australia can generate and export solar to Asia, South Asia, or hydrogen, you know, can be used in the mining industry where there's a requirement of high energy use. So I think the biggest determinant will be the political framing, how the issue of climate change is framed, because at the end of the day, it's about costs and benefits and how they're distributed in society. So I think, and you can add the moral dimension to it, which I think, in my opinion, is secondary, because each country sort of, or rather each society, for politicians to survive or keep their positions, they have to be to the most powerful groups. And I think another interesting question that you raised about rationality is very interesting, but you see, when you ask whether someone is rational in responding to something, there's an assumption, like in the statement that was made, that they're responding to the same thing. But climate change impacts vary across different regions. So the way, for example, in Kenya, we might approach it is like a threat to our economy because, for example, Kenya is a developing country, relies on agriculture for much, you know, a huge percentage of its GDP and employment. So climate change is viewed more in terms of adapting to climate change than to mitigating climate change. But in a country like Australia, it'll be viewed a little bit different, even though now the impacts of climate change are bringing up the discussion on how do we adapt to the increasing droughts, etc. And in some other places, like in the UK, it's more about emissions, reducing emissions. So it depends. People will react depending on also the kind of issue that is before them. So I think having one sort of an assumption that this is the issue for everyone and this is how they should respond is a little bit misleading. And I think acknowledging that there are very many different contexts of addressing this issue, even though it's a collective action issue, is very important.
Beautiful.
We mentioned a little bit about climate change policy priorities for each country is being different. So we read, and we discussed a little bit about this before, the EU free trade agreement with Australia. Would you explain to us what happens?
Oh, that's
briefly?
A very interesting topic. And just as a side comment, when I started working on my PhD at that time and I talked to people that I'm looking at sort of how environmental standards are designed in trade agreements, people weren't interested. Some people thought it was just a very interesting academic topic and that's sort of it. In came Trump and there was, you know, trade policy became, like a high politics issue. And when you combine it with now climate change, it becomes quite an interesting issue. So I'm actually writing my thesis on how countries are using trade agreements to pursue or otherwise, you know, climate policy, which is quite timely. And with the issue of the EU, this is my take. So the EU is looking at other avenues over and beyond the UN to sort of ramp up climate action. And one of the things they're doing, because Paris Agreement doesn't have a strong enforcement mechanism, because countries submit what they want to do and then they review each other, and then there's that ambition or expectation where they're supposed to strengthen their plans over time. You don't get punished for not doing that. So some people argue it's a very soft system, so that is based on trust. So you don't get to use the sticks, so it's not good enough for compliance. So what do you do if you're not getting the outcome that you want in one area? You shift to another area where you have an advantage. And for the EU, that's trade. The EU is a very big market where almost every country wants to send their exports to. And the EU knows that. So what do they do? So in exchange for you, they put conditions. In exchange for you accessing their market, you have to do a couple of other things. So they use that to leverage their, you know, the power of their market. So it's called, like, you know, using the market access as a bargaining power. So the debate between the EU and Australia is now the EU is using trade agreements to sort of enforce implementation of the Paris Agreement. And the current debate sort of is there are two schools of thought, and that's part of the theory that I'm developing for my thesis. Countries can either decide to, you know, separate issues where they say trade agreements should be only about trade and not any other issue. That is a stand that Australia has. Like, we are negotiating a trade agreement. It should be about trade and not other issues. If we need to talk about climate change, let's go to the Paris Agreement. But the EU is like, no. For you to get a trade agreement with us, you have to meet your commitments in the Paris Agreement. So that gives the EU a stronger position than they would have had, under the UN FCCC, which is the UN Agency for Climate Change. So for the EU, it views, you know, shifting the climate change issue to its trade, you know, as part of its trade policy works for the EU because it can sort of use that to push other countries to enforce or to use it as an enforcement. Because trade agreements are very appealing because they have a very strong enforcement mechanism. If you don't meet your obligations, there are very clear sanctions, you know, that, you know, either your preferences will be suspended, etc. So it's a more favorable area. And there are many other trade tools that the EU is using. Another one that is coming up is being developed, but it's also creating a lot of controversy, especially the EU and China, is about carbon tax. So the logic is very simple. The EU's argument is that they have very strong climate policies and environmental policies, so the industries in the EU have to meet very high standards, so they incur a higher cost. But if the EU is importing goods from other countries that have low environmental standards, then they have to pay the higher costs so that they meet sort of they meet sort of the costs that the EU industry is having. So, but the expected policy outcome is that the countries that want to export their goods to the EU would start using cleaner energy, for example, to produce or manufacture their goods in order to not to pay a tax to export them to the EU. So the EU in that way, their anticipation is that they're catalyzing climate action using their trade agreements. But there are two sides, maybe to conclude that point, there are two comments that are raised. Who, you know, that is a very potent tool. So who should it be used against? Mm. And so I found a shorthand way of doing it because there are ethical issues there. Should it be used to, because the EU is a very powerful actor, so should it use such potent tools for those countries that are able but unwilling to act on climate change? Or should it also use on those countries that are willing but unable to act on climate change to the level that the EU expects? So that's a normative issue, and I think it's part of the debate that we have. So some say it's fair game for the EU to push Australia because Australia has the ability, but it doesn't have the political will, as opposed to pushing a strong, smaller country to do the same. So, but that's part of the debate.
What's the outcome so far? Is Australia
The negotiations are still ongoing, so we don't know whether that will be a make or break issue. Or whether the EU will have sort of a stronger leverage, because similar issue occurred when Australia was negotiating its agreement with the US, but at that time it was during the Obama administration, and the US put its foot down, and Australia had to had to agree. So the question is whether the EU has as much muscle, and whether the other benefits from the trade agreement sort of outweigh the costs of signing up to such a commitment by Australia. So we'll see what sort of Australia decides on that. But that's a sticking issue for both countries.
Since you mentioned the US, what do you think about the Green New Deal?
So I think my thoughts about, I'll speak about the Green New Deal in my capacity as a political scientist. And the way I view it is like any other policy response. And it has its people who support it and those who oppose it. Again, as you said, it's an issue of costs and benefits. Who do you pass the costs of a certain climate action to? And part of the proponents of the Green New Deal, they argue that the fossil fuel industry has really profited from the industry or from sort of like the global economy running on fossil fuels. But also, they're not bearing much of the cost. And if there should be a response, they should bear much of the cost and not the citizens through taxation. But those who oppose that argue that the Green New Deal goes over and beyond environmental issues and brings in other issues. But also it brings to the surface some other issues. How do you balance, for example, like, you know, like democratic systems? To what degree do you does government intervene, you know, in affairs? And to what degree should some issues be contested through, you know, like Congress, etc.? So that debate is there. But what I'd say is, in my opinion, it's gotten traction in some places like the EU because it aligns with much with the EU policy and also like the political systems of the countries. But in a country like the US, you can...
Last question. The way we look at climate change now is pretty much shaped by how the media shapes climate change. But it may misrepresent what the actual climate change is about.
Is it somewhere along the lines of, do you believe that the media is manipulating the use of climate change as a... Is that what we're talking about? I think we had that discussion.
But I can get the gist of your question. And I think it is a very interesting question because the way I'd view climate change is as a cross-cutting issue. In fact, you called it a wicked problem. Some have called it a super wicked problem because it is that problem that is very complex and not easy. To give you an example, when the world faced a problem of the depletion of the ozone layer, there was a very quick and rapid fix. And part of the argument would be, theoretically, there was one source, very singular source of the problem, that is the CFCs and HFC chemicals. And it was very easy to find a substitute for those chemicals. And that is why the problem was solved very quickly. But if we look at climate change, the source of problems are so diffuse, you know, from agriculture, industry, transportation, almost everything that touches on the way of life. So dealing with climate change actually means rewriting or rearranging the global economy and the way of life. That is no mean feat, if that is the way you'd understand climate change. So different people will pick at different aspects of it, but I don't think it's possible to isolate it as a discrete issue which can be addressed singularly. And I think that might cause a lot of despair because it's so complex, it cuts across. But also, I think it's encouraging when people realize the complexity of the issue and they sort of start responding to that issue but in a way that sort of ends up addressing it. So it might not be sort of solved in the short term per se, but there are some short term actions, medium term actions, and long term actions. And I think the good thing is climate politics is now high level politics, which is a good thing, and people are chipping away at the different facets of it. So I think it's a very complex problem, but I think even communicating that it's a complex problem is a very good thing. And back to the issue of the media framing the issues, I think in some places, the interested parties, especially fossil fuel interests, have quite a monopoly on some media. So that's where there's a real concern in some areas. Not in all regions, of course, but in some areas it's quite acute. And from a political science perspective, you'd expect actors who always have a privileged access to things like media, politicians, they'd leverage that access, especially when they feel that their interests are very much threatened. So they'll double down. So in Australia, for example, the connection between the fossil fuel industry and the media, where there is, then you'd expect it to be stronger as the fossil fuel industry tries to still keep a foothold, as they know very strong climate action will inevitably impact on them. So that's part of a response that you would expect from vested interests. It's not an easy question, but it gets to the heart of the issue.
So thank you, Kennedy, for coming in and having a good old chat with us about the complexities and the hardships of discussing climate change and climate change policy international and at Australia's level. So thank you again for coming in. I thought I'd just let the audience know that from here on out, you might notice that we have to upload every second week because as master's students, unfortunately,
We have commitments.
We have commitments that we need to attune to. So we will start probably posting new uploads every fortnight. Just to make sure that we can get some research in and also get our assessments done at the same time.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me. This was a very interesting conversation, especially carrying on the initial conversation, you know, while having coffee. So
yeah.
I think it's really useful to have these conversations going. And I hope the reflections here were quite useful, but let's take the conversation forward.
No worries. And we hope to look forward to catching up with a coffee with you again in the future as well.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Thank you so much. All right, guys. So hopefully you have a great week. We'll see you in our next episode. So remember to subscribe, follow, or just like our Facebook page as well. And we'll catch you on our next episode. I'll catch you later.
See ya. Bye.